I think it's important for the listeners to understand that when doctors are faced with a brand new illness, a brand new pathogen, SARS-CoV-2, the illness COVID-19, and now we're presented with a brand new clinical dilemma of people who have received the COVID-19 vaccines, what we need to do is exactly what Dr. Chetty has done, is actually careful observation, making as many observations as he can, and then responding to those observations with empiric approaches that have scientific rationale. This is one of the purest examples of this being done. Others have said, and many know this, we've had U.S. Senate testimony on this, that we should wait, that we should do nothing and then do randomized trial after randomized trial until the randomized trials tell us what to do. And many of you know, I disagreed with this on the floor of the U.S. Senate because this is one of the few times in medicine where it is all about observation and empiric management. Dr. Chetty, what's your response to that?
I think you're exactly right, Dr. McCullough. When we're faced with such sudden critical situations, we don't have time for clinical trials. The clinical trials are not ethical in this situation. You got to look at what's in front of you. You got to make understanding of what's there. And you got to try and formulate a response to that based on the knowledge you have gained. So I expect that randomized trials have their place. I think it's more a construct of the pharmaceutical industry. It gives us an understanding of the unknown. So if we're looking at a new drug and how it works, then we do a randomized clinical trial and we get a bell-shaped curve of its effect, and our focus would be on the center of that bell to understand what's happening. But when we deal with the new illness, we're not dealing with something unknown. There's a vast experience out there with viruses and how they work and what they cause in the body. And so we have a basis of knowledge. And so when we look at patients and what's happening with the illness, we get a bell-shaped curve as well. But our concern is more with the tails of this curve and the unusual patients and the unusual presentations, and trying to make sense of those presentations so that we can understand the nature of the illness. So I think the unusual presentations give us a lot more. And I think a lot of science comes to the fore when physicians sit in the doctor's lounge at the end of the day and discuss all their unusual cases, rather than any randomized trials. So I think it should be left to people with experience to make sense very early on of what we see. And of course, with medical intervention, we have drugs that we've been using for many years. We're well aware of the risks that they pose. We're well aware of their safety profiles. So we shouldn't be restricted in trying those drugs. We're not posing any risk to the patient itself. And by assessing the speed to recovery and clinical outcomes, it gives us an understanding of the underlying mechanisms that we suspect to be at play. And that's the way we solve medical problems, not through any randomized trials itself. So I think clinicians, by tying clinicians' hands during this pandemic, we've stifled a lot of development in treating patients and adversely affected their quality of lives and the outcomes.
Well, there's no doubt that you weren't stifled and I wasn't stifled in our practice of medicine, making observations, empiric treatment choices. I've been fortunate. I've tried to publish as much as I can, given the limitations that we have in terms of speed of publication and bias at the level of the editorial offices and the journal. But we've been talking now for greater than 30 minutes, Dr. Chetty, and we have not mentioned hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, Paxlovid or molnupiravir. We have not mentioned a drug that would be organized to reduce viral replication. Can you give us your thoughts throughout the pandemic about how management could be achieved without trying to address viral replication as a primary pathogenic driver?
Okay. When it comes to the virus itself, I think the trust in natural immunity can't be ignored. With all the patients that I've seen with COVID, every single one of them had viral symptoms. Every single one of them by about the fourth or fifth day of illness showed signs of improvement. That's a clear indication of a robust immune response, that you're managing to curtail the infection without really any intervention. And so I think the virus itself is easily dealt with by our natural immune response. There were those patients who showed signs of a high viral load, having severe joint aches and pains, very high spiking temperatures. It was only in those patients that I considered decreasing viral load, and with drugs like hydroxychloroquine. But I used that for very few patients and very far between. It was wholly unnecessary. Symptomatic treatment seemed to bring complete resolution from the viral phase of the illness. So I think that the mortality and morbidity of COVID illness lies in the second phase of the illness, which is due to reaction to spike protein. So my understanding of the illness has always been that the primary pathogen in COVID illness is spike protein and not coronavirus. Coronavirus is just the vector for spike protein itself. So I've never really put any effort into antiviral therapies. And I think that brings my perspective on the vaccinations as well. The vaccinations only seek to curb the virus itself, but this disease is not so much about a virus, but more about a protein and the body's response to that protein itself. So antiviral drugs really didn't have a place in me treating COVID. And we've seen that with antivirals in hospital treatments, they've really shown no benefit. I think by the eighth or ninth day, when a patient eventually gets into hospital, their viral loads are already on the way down and they already have a good immune response to the virus itself. And we're dealing with a completely different kind of pathology in the second phase. And so antivirals won't really be of any benefit at that point in the illness. I've also noticed that patients with very low viral loads who had very transient mild viral illness in the first phase had very severe illness in the second phase. There was no correlation between the two. So I didn't see a benefit of actually attempting to decrease viral load in an attempt to decrease the severity of the second phase of illness. I didn't see a correlation between the two. So antivirals really have played no part in the treatment that I've instituted with patients. I don't see it as a common drug or a common modality. It's never been a common modality in self-limiting viral illnesses, and it might impact on our ability to develop a robust immune response.
Well, I can tell you that is such innovative thinking. It's just the opposite of the Western world thinking right now, where there's just such a hyper focus on the virus with monoclonal antibodies. Now we have Paxlovid, which is a chymase like 3 inhibitor plus a protease inhibitor, or molnupiravir, which is a polymerase inhibitor, the use of remdesivir, which is a polymerase inhibitor. There's a hyper focus there. And I think your innovation, which influenced me in my practice, is to focus much more on inflammation, and the term you use is hypersensitivity. And I know how you're applying it, because there are principles of hypersensitivity that are occurring in our patients. And then when a paper comes in from University of Virginia, where it's famotidine and aspirin and a substantial mortality reduction, that's one of the biggest mortality in heart outcome reductions that we've seen in observation. Dr. Chetty, it looks like you have been proved right on so many of these principles, that it does take drugs in combination. The middle and back end phases of the illness are far more important than the initial phases. And it makes sense. People don't die in the first 1 or 2 days of the illness, but they certainly do after 2 weeks. Or, I've had a death in my practice at 6 weeks into the illness. We've done autopsies on these deaths. And at that stage, the lungs are filled with blood clots.
Yeah. Dr. McCullough, we've missed the pathology. Focusing on a virus and thinking that we're dealing with a viral pneumonia was where the mistakes started, where things started to go wrong. We've all seen viral pneumonias previously, and we understand the symptom presentation in that kind of pathology. And with the first few patients that presented to me breathless post eighth day, I realized very quickly that it's not a viral pneumonia. There was no crepitations. There was no fluid in the lungs. The cough was dry. The patients had no symptoms of severe illness, so no fever and that kind of thing. Patients were just breathless. They were just breathless, but if you examined them from afar, you wouldn't know that they were acutely unwell. And when I looked at the pulmonology around the illness, they were able to breathe easily. There was no restriction to air flow as such, so no wheezing sounds. Their ability to expire was uninhibited. The only thing that I noticed was an inability to take a deep breath, and that indicated the lack of elasticity in the lung or lack of expansile capacity. And that ties in well with a sudden inflammatory process in the substance of the lung rather than any secretions filling the lung itself. So the lung itself was swollen, tissue being swollen, and that would impede oxygen transfer and it would impede the expansile capacity of the lung. And that's what drew my attention to this not being a typical pneumonia. There was some other pathology at play. And so I considered it to be a pneumonitis, triggered by either hypersensitivity or some kind of allergen or exposure to something. The progress as well of the illness, the severity, was what was very telling. I've had patients come to me on a Monday with a sore throat. It had started on that Monday and it was documented as their first day of illness. By the second day, they had almost completely recovered. During that week, they had recovered to the point where they engaged in sporting activities and that kind of thing, and I thought they had recovered completely from the illness. To the day a week later, on a Monday, they got up feeling tired. By lunchtime, they noticed the onset of breathlessness, and by the evening, were already becoming oxygen dependent. Now, pneumonias do not progress with that speed, and of course, they were perfectly fine the day before. So that's what drew my attention. This did not follow the progression of a pneumonia. The speed was different. The symptom presentation was different. And so I knew that post eighth day was where the mortality and morbidity resided. And there was a trigger on the eighth day starting a separate process. And so the understanding of a biphasic nature to this illness itself. And I think that's where we as the medical fraternity could have looked a little closer. I think the lockdowns, the isolations all lended to that. Patients were coming into hospital on the 14th and 15th day critically ill. And of course, at that point, it's very difficult to tell what the triggering event was. So doctors in hospital were spending their times trying to save people's lives, looking at all the multi-system failures they were presented with. But there wasn't this understanding that it was triggered by a single event somewhere on the eighth day. And I think that's where the examination of patients following the trend of the illness is vitally important.
You know, I can tell you that I had the illness myself, and that's exactly what happened. What you described is my lungs felt stiff. There was a stiffness, like I couldn't fully expand them. I was able to go out and run, which I did, and I exercised, and, you know, it took time to recover. And this was, I imagine I was ill during the alpha wave in the United States. And that's exactly what I felt. Recently, Dr. Hazen and myself, we've published that we can manage patients who have hypoxemia at home, that it doesn't require hospitalization unless patients really can't keep up with the work of breathing or if they cannot have adequate mentation. Do you agree with that? I mean, if patients have an oxygen saturation below 94%, do they have to be hospitalized or can they be managed at home in your experience?
Dr. McCullough, I think I was thrown into the deep end with this pandemic. There were patients that I would have liked to have hospitalized, because of the protocols in the hospital being enforced and showing really no benefit, patients were terrified of being hospitalized. So I had to treat critically ill patients using ICU sort of care on an outpatient basis. Now, the most just to lend some credence to what I'm saying, the worst patient that I've seen so far was a lady of 75 years old, diabetic and hypertensive, who was brought to me on the 12th day of her illness. She lives about 200 kilometers away from my practice. She got into distress. They called out the paramedics. Her oxygen saturation on oxygen was 45%. She was breathless on oxygen. They had put up a drip for her and they were going to rush her to ICU. Her son insisted that she be brought to Port Edward and he paid for the ambulance for the day. So I was presented with a patient on a stretcher, barely conscious, with a 40%, 45% saturation on 5 or 6 liters of oxygen. I drew her blood samples. I gave her a promethazine injection and a steroid injection. And I started her immediately on a high-dose steroid antihistamine, the usual Montelukast. And I advised the paramedics to please leave the oxygen cylinder with her for a day or two. I would expect that her saturations would improve, which they did. I called her back on the Thursday. She presented on a Monday morning. I called them back on a Thursday to reassess. When I had seen her on Thursday, she was saturating at 88% on room air. She could take the mask off. She could speak to me. From her bloods on the first visit, her CRPs were over 500. Her interleukins were over 500. And her D-dimer was, I think, 14,000.
Wow.
On the second visit, her D-dimer had gone up to 68,000. But her interleukin 6 and her CRPs showed a good downward trend. At that second visit, she was looking clinically much improved. So I started Xarelto, rivaroxaban, at 15 milligrams BD. And on that second visit, her general practitioner from her town came along with her because he was amazed at her recovery. And this was all still done at home. And he was educated about what I was trying to achieve. And he contacted me the Monday, a week after I had first seen her. All her clear markers had returned to normal. She was saturating at 98% on room air. And he had no further concerns. I did highlight the possibility of developing diabetes later on because of the shock that she'd been through. And I think 2 months later, he contacted me to say, yes, she's become diabetic, but she's managed well on treatment. So in a case like that, if I could manage a patient like that on home-based care without requiring hospitalization, I think that majority of patients could have been managed with home-based care. I've had patients, Dr. McCullough, with 80% saturations who have improved to 90% and 95% within 4 hours of administration of the first dose of promethazine. And so in my practice, even though I see a lot of dyspneic patients, I still don't have oxygen in my practice. The speed to recovery when it comes to oxygen saturations is so fast that by the next day, I have patients breathing calmly without the requirement for oxygen.
That is such a profound set of observations. And we're unfortunately out of time, so we're going to have to leave it here. But I've learned so much from you. We've covered antihistamines, H1, H2, drugs that influence the prostaglandin system, the leukotriene system, platelet aggregation, and then thrombosis. And without really having to address the viral replication, which is wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, I think too much of time has been spent on being distracted by the virus itself. And yeah, it's kept us off the real culprit.
And it's phenomenal. The one thing I learned from this is promethazine. In the United States, we call it Phenergan. We use it primarily as an antiemetic, but it is available orally. And that seems like a wonderful suggestion, no doubt.
You know, Dr. McCullough, with treating patients early, every patient that I caught early and treated early never developed long COVID. I don't have a single case of long COVID in patients that presented early to me. And promethazine seems to have serotonin effects. It has this broad spectrum. So I think it might have been the reason that I didn't experience any of the long COVID issues that other doctors experienced. So I think promethazine and its broad diversity of effect was vital in the success that I had early on in the pandemic. Well, I change patients over to a milder non-sedative antihistamine once they've clinically improved. I'm cautious of rebound on medication withdrawal.
That's a terrific set of observations. And again, we're going to have to leave it here. I must want you to come back for another session as we progress. But we've learned a lot from you, Dr. Chetty. I think historians will record you as a leader, as someone who is a true scientist, a true empiricist, and most of all, a doctor, a real doctor who stepped up when it was needed most to save as many patients as you possibly could. And again, I want to congratulate you for being part of our broader team advancing care for COVID-19 patients.
I'm humbled, Dr. McCullough, and I thank you. I thank you for having me.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.